This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this Sunday morning. Today, we'll revisit two conversations from last week. Jack Russell Weinstein, host of the Why Radio Show, which will air later today, will talk about this month's subject, what is the difference between a religion and a cult? And we'll hear Charles Gorecki, CEO of the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND, explain what could be a game changer in the efforts to keep the state's coal-fired power plants online by sharply reducing greenhouse gas emissions. First, though, an update on the COVID-19 pandemic from our news director, Dave Thompson.
This week, there was an easing of travel restrictions due to COVID-19 in North Dakota. Governor Burgum explained it at his Friday briefing.
This allows for people to travel freely within the United States and releases requirements for people returning to our state, even from those areas that were previously defined as high outbreak areas, releases people from having to self-isolate or quarantine when they come back. The exception to this is international travelers. This is in alignment also with CDC guidelines for travel, and people commuting to and from North Dakota for work, essential supplies and services, even if it involves crossing an international border, like from Canada, that is exempt from this order.
But Burgum also said North Dakotans should still try to limit travel to essential trips.
So essential trips, essential errands. Travel is necessary for a job that is considered essential or to provide medical or care to home to others. And if you are traveling, even around the state, always a good idea to minimize the number of stops. If you minimize the number of stops, minimize the number of interactions you have, the number of door handles you might touch, you're protecting yourself and your loved ones, because the less transmissible moments that you create or experience, the less likely that the virus is going to be able to continue moving.
Burgum also announced a nonprofit research institute has come up with a way to decontaminate personal protective equipment. It's coming to North Dakota. Burgum says the systems set up to decontaminate N95 masks and respirators are already being set up in Bismarck. They're from Battelle Memorial Institute, and in cooperation from FEMA, will help healthcare providers preserve their protective equipment free of charge. There are 60 of these systems being distributed nationwide. North Dakota was the 26th state to receive one. Burgum says shipping to and from that system will also be done free of charge.
The way it's going to work, healthcare systems will collect those masks that are worn each day in accordance with the approved procedure. The PPE will be labeled with barcode serial numbers that will be used for tracking that PPE in a chain of custody. And this will ensure that each provider, whether you're a hospital system or a dental office, that you get your own respirators back.
Burgum said turnaround time will vary depend on volume and will allow for each N95 mask to be reused 3 times without degrading its filter performance. He says up to 10,000 masks can be done per cycle, up to twice a day. He says this will save North Dakotans hundreds of thousands of dollars each day and will also ensure North Dakota will not run out of personal protective equipment. Cass County by far has the most number of COVID-19 cases in North Dakota. Grand Forks County is in second place. Burgum was asked about that in his Friday briefing.
But it's been concentrated within long-term care and long-term care workers. And then the other reason why we think it's high is that even though, you know, there's a lot of attention given the fact that we did hold some successful weekend mass testings, we've done actually less testing in Cass County per capita than we have in other places. And generally, when we do more testing, then the rate of positives tends to go down. So we want to get our testing rates up, even as we're being targeted about who we're trying to hit. We have a high concentration of the 218 long-term care facilities that are in state. We've got a large portion of those are in Cass County, and they're in Cass County, and then they're also large facilities. So then they end up having a large number of workers too. And so it is a place where we know from the rest of the nation that outbreaks can occur and they're hard to control, but if you've got someone who's working in a long-term care facility who becomes positive, but we didn't catch that, and then they go home to their neighborhood, their family, then that becomes a challenge. So it's one of the things where we've got to work extra harder on the contact tracing in Fargo.
Burgum says there will be more mass testing events in Fargo. Minnesota's Governor Tim Walz is launching what he called a battle plan to deal with the spread of COVID-19 in Minnesota's long-term care facilities. With more, here's Prairie Public's Todd McDonald.
Governor Walz says the virus has hit the facilities hard, and the state is now fully prepared to go on the offensive. He says by having Minnesotans shelter in place, they've been able to generate the needed personal protection equipment, the testing, and other resources that will be needed.
It's a plan pretty much predicated on the best practices, and while it seems very obvious, much of it was dependent on things that we did not have 30 days ago and we do have today.
Minnesota Health Department Commissioner Jan Malcolm says the plan is based on 5 points and should be easy to implement for most facilities. She says the state is also ready to help implement the plan.
Providing additional support for facilities to keep their staffing levels up, to ensure that they can get the personal protective equipment they need, to better train their workers on resident care and infection prevention, and building and maintaining enough bed capacity for residents with COVID-19 who don't need to be in the hospital.
Governor Walz says staffing has long been an issue for nursing homes and other care facilities. He says when you add a pandemic to the mix, the issue takes on a new light.
Folks that we pay the least amount of money have been on the front lines of this and the hardest thing to do. So it shouldn't surprise us now when this is super dangerous, doesn't pay people a lot of money, that they're nervous about it. So I do think it's going to take us figuring this out. The good news is I think right now as we speak, the legislature is talking about what they can do on the COVID-19 fund.
Officials say residents of Minnesota's long-term care facilities make up less than 1% of the state's population, but account for more than 15% of Minnesota's COVID-19 cases and 80% of the deaths related to the virus. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
The deadline for reopening Minnesota bars and restaurants strikes this week. Governor Walz has not yet said whether he will extend the deadline or not. He says he understands the urgency. However,
folks are not going to go back, and it is overwhelmingly in polling across the country, and we see it here. They're not going to go back if they don't feel safe.
Also lapsing this week, the governor's stay-at-home order. Walz says even if he decides to extend the order, he knows there are those who will defy it.
We had these discussions about your own personal behavior. If you're by yourself, you make the decision you need to make. But just like smoking in restaurants, we passed a clean air law here, and people no longer smoke. And I think society can't imagine a time when people smoke next to others where secondhand smoke was a problem. So I think Minnesotans have proven they care about their neighbor. They understand that these restrictions are that way.
Walz says he doesn't want to minimize the economic plan, but he says we're learning that reopening needs to be done. And for Prairie Public and Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. On Thursday, our guest was UND philosophy professor Jack Russell Weinstein, the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life, which airs today at 5 Central on this station.
I'm really happy to be here, and this is more social distancing than we need, but at least it counts as social, period.
Well, today, the name of your department has some relevance to the discussion we're going to have. You are the Chester Fritz Distinguished Professor in the UND Department of Philosophy and Religious Studies, and we're going to talk about what is the difference between a religion and a cult. Why did you choose that question?
Well, you know, it's just something that interested me, and I actually asked my colleague Chuck Miller for a suggestion of a guest, and he gave me Susan Palmer, who was really interesting. And, you know, being a professor of philosopher, a professor of philosophy has been really interesting because many, many departments, most departments, are philosophy and religion. And that was a budgetary decision that people made in the 1980s, combine the two departments because they think that there are similarities between the two disciplines, but they're not as close as you think. What they are different, though, from are departments of theology. Departments of religious studies study religion academically as sociologists, as political scientists, as interested academic observers, whereas theologians are studying religion from within a particular point of view. So I have to say, I have never met more atheists than I did when I started joining religious studies departments.
So what's in a word? How does a philosopher define religion?
Well, that is a good question, and it took me a while to get an answer from Susan. It's one of those amorphous things. But what a religion has is certain characteristics. They're organized and communal. They share a common experience. They share a myth. They have doctrines of belief. They share values. And so it's not like you can say it's a religion if it meets this particular point of view. Rather, it's a religion if it fulfills our cultural and social needs to help us answer certain aspects of our life, what happens after we die, what is a good person, and also gives meaning to our day-to-day experience. Why does this happen? What is valuable, and how should we treat other people? So the very question of what a religion is a huge debate within the field.
So why did you want to discuss it with Susan Palmer? She's a sociologist.
She is a sociologist, but she is a leading scholar in the study of new religious movements. And new religious movements, again, terminology, that they like to replace the word cult. Cult is often a derogatory term. Cult, when we think of cults, we think of Jonestown and people dying of Kool-Aid. We think of mass sex orgies. We think of people who are dangerous and undermine our values. And of course, some new religions have those aspects. But most new religions are sectarians who break away from a church, or people who have some sort of revelation and want to share, people who help others heal. These new religions can come out of yoga classes. They can come out of, you know, things like Alcoholics Anonymous. They can come out of just couples having ideas as how to share. And so if we use the word cult, we already dismiss it as dangerous or not worth our attention. And Susan Palmer is interested in new religious movements, or baby religions, as she likes to call them.
So is one person's religion another person's cult?
Certainly, that is the perspective of some people, but I think Susan wants to change that. I think she wants to say other people's religions are other people's religions, right? I mean, there is a foreignness, right? It is very hard to understand a religion if you're not an adherent. It's very hard to get what people see about it, but it's also incredibly hard to see what other people see in their own marriage, right? Or why they like a certain kind of music. But we don't dismiss people's partners because they're not for us. This is the same thing with religions. Perhaps you are attracted to, or perhaps you have been recruited by a small group of people who have a shared vision and they want you to be a part of that. There's nothing inherently bad about that, and there's nothing inherently dangerous about that. So someone else might call it a cult, but for me or for the other people, it may be a healthy group of people who bring out the best in me and help me give a vision of a future that I can contribute to.
So were Abraham or Jesus Christ or Muhammad, in a sense, the philosophers of their time who came up with a belief system that caught on?
They absolutely were. Each of them started a new religion that then caught on. I don't know if you're a fan of The Life of Brian, the great Monty Python film. But yes. there's a moment where you get all, where you have several of these early Christian denominations at the Colosseum, and they're all flipping each other off because they have tiny, tiny little differences, and that means that they're not the true Christians, right? Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, they all started as a new religion, and there were lots of competitions that had slight variations. But they grew to be these monolithic, wrong word monolithic, because there's a lot of difference within them, but these massive historical institutions. Now, they come with myths, right? So Jesus didn't start, I need to re-say that. Jesus had the revelation, and then Paul starts the church. But did Jesus actually have a revelation? I don't know. I wasn't there, right? I'm not Jesus. I'm not God. So it's a matter of faith. So was Jesus just a rabbi with an idea who started a new religion, or was he a divine instrument? The religion over time establishes that as part of their story, as part of their narrative, and part of being a Christian is accepting that, but you can certainly look at early Christianity in exactly the same filter that you look at all of the different new religions that exist in the world today.
So Christianity would have been considered a cult at its outset. Its practitioners were persecuted. It was ridiculed. So as you get adherence, as you establish a governance, does that make a new religious movement a religion?
Well, certainly what Susan is going to say is that the new religious movement is a religion from the moment it starts developing these things, right? From the development, it has a few people and has a vision and has a story. But whether it's regarded as legitimate or meaningful by the culture around it, that's a process that takes time. Obviously, if it's just two or three people in a house, no one's even going to notice. But if it's 100 people in a building downtown or in a compound 2 miles away from the city, and people are coming in to shop and to sell their wares, and they wear particularly noticeable clothing or have certain behaviors that stand out, then people are going to notice. And so once people notice, they're going to decide, is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? Is this a threat? Is this an asset to our community? And that's where all the normal stuff comes in, the politics, the rhetoric, the marketing. And if the group, if the religion is contributing positive to the town, to the community, to the city, then why not accept it?
Well, you also have these religious movements like Hare Krishna or Munis that look or act so differently than the accepted norm that they're considered a cult. That gets us to a sort of a core issue here. What is the objective? Sometimes we call something a cult because we don't believe it has a legitimate objective. Not saying that those two didn't. But maybe we've got a Jim Jones, for example, in Jonestown, and it's the cult of personality. It's the cult of Jim. That just doesn't seem right. It doesn't seem religious.
Certainly, charismatic leaders have an advantage in getting people than more sort of timid, even boring folks, right? That charisma is an advantage. I would imagine Jesus had a tremendous amount of charisma. I would imagine Moses did, and Muhammad did as well. But you know what? So did John Lennon and Paul McCartney. Think about how much abuse people got in the 60s for having the quote-unquote long hair that the Beatles wore that we don't even consider long anymore, right? Every musical movement has the same thing. My kid is interested in death metal. She's going straight to hell, right? I mean, that response to charisma is found in a lot of other things. And so I don't necessarily think it's the case that having a charismatic leader is necessarily a negative or a danger. Look, I try very hard to be an entertaining and charismatic professor, in part because students get bored in class and they think about other things. And if I can have this emotional connection with my students, then they're going to pay attention, they're going to do their work, and they're going to write better papers. Now, I don't want to be a cult leader, and I don't want to abuse my position. But if your job is to communicate God's vision or the revelation that you had, then you're going to want that same kind of attractive personality that I have in front of my class.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. You can hear it this Sunday at 5 Central on the Prairie Public Radio Network. Jack, is there a way to evaluate the dogma of a belief system to make it virtuous? And I realize that word itself, virtuous, has some difficult meanings. But what about the belief system itself? Can a system be intrinsically good?
Well, so the sociologist, right, Susan Palmer, is going to say that her job is to bracket those questions, meaning to put them aside. She wants to study these new religions as cultural and social behavior and phenomena. So what they believe is irrelevant to her. but I'm a philosopher. And I'm old-fashioned enough personally to believe that there's such a thing as truth and there's such a thing as accurate morality. And so I certainly am going to evaluate the religion's claims based on things that I know, right? If your religion is about torturing puppies, then I'm going to say it's a bad religion. If your religion involves petting puppies' bellies and giving them treats, then I'm going to think it's a good religion. But of course, I have moral commitments that are themselves derived from my culture, my own religious background, the hundreds and hundreds of ethics books that I've read over my life. And so what I can't do is offer a purely objective God's eye view of what is moral and what is not. I have to have conviction in my ability to reason. I have to have faith in my sense that I understand how the world works and that I can make good and bad decisions reasonably informed fashion. And then there are people who are just think I'm fundamentally corrupt. There, you know, I am Jewish and I'm moderately observant Jew to a certain extent. And there are Christians and Muslims and Buddhists and Hindus in the world who find that utterly repulsive. And that's their prerogative because they are committed to a moral system. So the sociologist wants to put those questions aside. The philosopher wants to address those questions, but recognizes that anytime we ask a moral question, we ask it from within a moral system, and I'm not God, so I can't give an absolute answer.
There's kind of a superiority implied in a lot of religious practice, though. You've got Reform Judaism and Orthodox Judaism. You got Roman Catholic, Orthodox Catholic. You've got Southern Baptist and, Congregational. So what about that piece of it? Doesn't that ultimately sort of make the idea of a religion being some kind of a superior line of worship or superior line of thinking, one being better than the other, doesn't that kind of belie the whole purpose of religion?
One of the things I always tell my students is there's no such thing as Judaism. There's no such thing as Christianity. There's no such thing as Islam. There are Judaisms, Christianities, and Islams. And as a Reform Jew and a liberal Jew, I have a lot more in common with a liberal Muslim than I do with an Orthodox and conservative Jew, because my moral convictions about gay rights, about women's equality, about, the joy of eating bacon, right? I mean, these are absolute convictions that I have that someone on the very conservative or fundamentalist side is not going to have. And so do I think I'm morally superior to them? Part of me does. Do they think they're morally superior to me? Part of them does. And Alistair McIntyre, I wrote a book on a Catholic philosopher named Alistair McIntyre, and he addresses this, and he says, part of the issue here is that what we are committed to is our own conception of truth. When I think that my morality is true, I am committing to it in a way that excludes other people's truths. What we do, however, in America is live in a society where we say, you can privately be committed to those truths, but politically, you have to let other people's truths have the same access to the world as yours. So we have freedom of religion because the Orthodox Jew and the fundamentalist Muslim have as much right to state what they believe as I and the liberal Muslim have, and we can't take that away from each other. But those are political claims and political commitments rather than theological claims and theological commitments. It gets very complicated very quickly.
Speaking of those distinctions, political versus philosophical or religious, you've got tax exemptions for religious entities. Churches and temples don't pay taxes, businesses do. Why is that appropriate?
Well, that is a constitutional question, right? So our First Amendment says that Congress shall make no law infringing upon or establishing other religions. And so how the Supreme Court has decided to interpret that is to say that the government should remain, quote unquote, neutral on these things and let religions run their course. But the Supreme Court has decided and legislators have decided that we have a compelling political interest to cultivate religious beliefs because religions tend to make people a bit more orderly? Religions tend to keep people in line, and religions tend to promote a certain set of values. And those values are values that our society holds to. Often nonviolence, often forgiveness, often pro-education, depending on the religion. And so ultimately what the government says is, by promoting religious belief, we get enough political and social benefit that we are willing to give them a tax write-off. Now, there are lots of people who think that this is unjustified and unfair, and this is a fight that goes on and on. But really, because it's a government question or a governance question, it's a quid pro quo. And America has always had a very complicated relationship with religion because Christianity has played a strong part in it, but many of the founders were not particularly Christian. They were deists rather than theists, which means they believed in a creator God, but not an interventionist God. And they wanted room for religions that they anticipated, like Judaism, but they also wanted rooms for religions they didn't anticipate, like Hare Krishna's or Rastafarianism. And those are political questions. They're not theological questions.
And ultimately, this is something that exists within the individual, because the belief system in a religion, or for that matter, something that might not be somebody else's religion, ultimately resides with the individual. What I believe is what I believe, and other people be damned.
And I can tell you the exact moment where this changes. It's in the 17th century, and it's by a philosopher named John Locke, who, when he's describing what will eventually become our form of government, a limited form of government, he says that belief is is not the purview of the temporal sovereign. And what that means is religious belief is business of God, who is outside time and who is in charge of all of us. Sovereign means the person who's in charge. And religious belief is not to be limited by the government, who is in time, whose job is to help us, you know, be free enough to make our own decisions. So from that moment forward, the individualist tradition, what gets called the liberal tradition, although liberal means something different now, the liberal tradition is committed to the idea that religion is private and not public. And this distinction between private and public is essential in our modern world. And in America right now, the Christian voters are amongst themselves engaged in a huge debate as to whether religion should stay private or whether the government should be involved in religious decisions.
Jack Russell Weinstein is the host of Why? Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. The question this Sunday at 5 Central is, what is the difference between a religion and a cult? And his guest is Susan Jean Palmer, a Canadian sociologist of religion and an author. Jack, that's a very deep vein of discussion. Thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you so much. It was the tip of the iceberg. We could do it for hours.
More Main Street in a moment.
I'm Bill Thomas, director of radio at Prairie Public. Public radio has always been a community effort, and that's especially true in difficult times. Your support allows us to keep you connected with trusted local news that you need to help navigate this crisis. We're covering COVID-19 with a series of interactive town halls, as well as our daily reporting on how the crisis is impacting North Dakota. As some members are forced to reduce their support, it's crucial for the viability of Prairie Public that those who can still continue to support it. If you value Prairie Public, especially now, and your means allow, please add to your monthly sustaining membership. A rising tide can lift all boats, and your added monthly funds can help make up the difference for those who can't give right now. Please visit prairiepublic.org, click on the donate button, and pay it forward for yourself and all of the Prairie region.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Charles Gorecki. He is the CEO of the Energy and Environmental Research Center at the University of North Dakota, and he joins us today to talk about Project Tundra. Charles, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks, Doug. Great to be here.
A little bit of background, first of all, for our listeners who may not know about the mission of the Energy and Environmental Research Center. Lay it out for us.
Yeah, so the EERC, or Energy and Environmental Research Center, is part of the University of North Dakota. We're a non-teaching branch, And our vision is to lead the world in developing solutions to energy and environmental challenges.
And this is an important time for that, I take it.
Absolutely. We have about 200 employees at the EERC, 220 if you count temporaries and students. We have a lot of great partners in the state and around the country and world that are certainly experiencing some challenges at the moment.
Well, let's talk about the challenge of Project Tundra. What is it? I know that you're working with Minn Kota Power on this. Why is it important?
Project Tundra, as you've already pointed out, is a project that's led and managed by Minn Kota Power. And the EERC is really grateful to be part of the team that's supporting Project Tundra. So what Project Tundra is Minn Kota's vision to see the potential for CO2 capture on their Milton R. Young Power facility near Center, North Dakota, and then capturing that carbon dioxide, compressing it, and storing it in the subsurface for dedicated storage, or sending it to oil fields for enhanced oil recovery.
On April 24th, there was an announcement by the U.S. Department of Energy's Office of Fossil Energy that they're going to be distributing about $131 million for carbon capture and utilization and storage project. Of that, $17 million plus goes to this particular project. How does it work?
Yeah, so in this particular case, we have been working with Minn Kota for a number of years now on a program that the Department of Energy started called Carbon Safe. We were selected about 3 years ago for a phase two effort, which looked at the potential for capturing and storing carbon dioxide in the subsurface near the Milton R. Young Power Facility and also Basin Electric's Antelope Valley Power Facilities. And in Carbon Safe Phase 2, we actually drilled what we would call a characterization well near each of those power facilities to look at the geology and see if it was suitable to inject and store CO2. In these formations are filled currently with salt water. They don't have any potential use now or in the future. And so that was very successful. We put in a proposal for a phase three, really focused around the Milton R. Young Power Facility. And we were selected, as you just pointed out, $17 million from the Department of Energy, and then accompanying cost share from Minn Kota, Schlumberger, and Computer Modeling Group. And what we'll be doing in this part of the project is drilling a well that would potentially become a monitoring well or an injection well as part of the CO2 storage aspect. And including working towards getting a permit from the North Dakota Industrial Commission, who has primacy over the injection of carbon dioxide in the state.
So there are a number of processes here. One is separating the CO2 from the exhaust plume of the plant. Then you've got to inject it into the ground. I assume that takes some sort of power supply, some pumps or something. And then you've got to have a safe place underground, and from the looks of it, it's about a mile or so underground, to sequester it, to store it.
That's correct, yeah. And so this project is really focused on just the storage aspect. We also have several other projects, and Minn Kota has several projects looking at the other parts of the CCUS, or the carbon capture. So Minn Kota actually was the recipient of a FEED study, so front-end engineering design project, looking at basically the design and engineering of a capture facility at the plant. So they were also, that's a separate award that Minn Kota was selected for, looking at the capture side. As you've also mentioned, after you captured it, then you would compress it to a dense phase so that it's easy to transport and inject. And then it's the storage aspect, which we're looking at with Carbon Safe.
So what will the $17 million grant that was awarded on the 24th of April allow you to do?
It'll allow us to drill one of those wells that I mentioned, which would either become an injection well in the future or a monitoring well. We'll be able to collect the data to ensure that the geology is suitable, which we already expect it to be, but it'll give us that confirmation. That data will be used to construct the permits that Minn Kota would submit, that would the state of North Dakota has primacy over, that would give us the project team, that is, the ability to inject and store carbon dioxide in the future.
How do you determine a safe place to sequester CO2?
there's a number of different criteria that we look for in a site when we're trying to determine if it's suitable for geologic storage. We first want to make sure it's, in general, we want a site to be about 3,000 feet or deeper in the subsurface. At that depth, you have pressure and temperature, which allows the CO2 to be in dense phase, so it takes up less room in the subsurface. Then we would look at a formation that was permeable or has the ability to easily be injected into. We have found a number of those formations that are deeper than 3,000 feet, as you mentioned, about over 5,000 feet near the Minn Kota plant. And you would also look at, for suitable seals. So these would be like shales. So what we're looking for as far as an injection target would be maybe a sandstone, something that is currently filled with salt water, and we would inject carbon dioxide into that. And we would look for impermeable seals, and these are usually shales or salts. In this case, we have shales and some salts mixed in with the above the target formation, which is the Broom Creek, or that's the primary target.
Now, this is a test of the technology. How much room or how much space or how much sequester capability would you need to have for a plant like the Milton R. Young plant?
Milton R. Young, if they were to capture all of their CO2 from the Unit 2, would be close to 4 million tons of carbon dioxide per year. So you would need, if over a, maybe let's say a 20-year time period or a 25-year time period, you would need enough space for 100 million tons of carbon dioxide, which we have done a lot of assessments over the past two decades. Initially, we did assessments on the geology of the North Dakota and surrounding region for its potential for storage. We later, through a number of different projects, did pilot tests. Then we did full demonstration tests. We worked on technology development for monitoring and reducing risk characterization technologies. And so we've come a long ways in understanding the suitability. And as far as a geologically superior place to store carbon dioxide, the Williston Basin, which is what we have here in North Dakota, is an excellent target for storing whether it be CO2 or produced water or anything like that. It's already proven that it can successfully trap and capture millions of barrels of oil, and it has done that for millions of years.
So would you have to an ongoing search for suitable sites, or is the site that you have found near the Milton R. Young plant suitable for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, Milton R. Young site would be suitable. Part of the Carbon Safe effort was, this was originally a research effort from the Department of Energy. We needed to find suitable targets that their call was at least 50 million tons of storage, which is what we started looking at. But when we started working closer with Minn Kota, recognized that it would maybe be 100 million tons if they were to capture everything from Unit 2. And there is certainly plenty of space in the subsurface. The Broom Creek Formation itself has billions of tons of storage potential.
Charles Gorecki is the CEO of the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND. We're talking about Project Tundra, which would sequester carbon dioxide from the Milton R. Young Generating Plant in North Dakota, a very large plant. Charles, you mentioned that the carbon dioxide, when it's at that depth and under pressure and heat, changes a bit. Is it ever extractable, or would it ever blow out, or is there how does it change?
As we go deeper into the subsurface, just like you would, for example, scuba diving, as you go deeper underwater, you experience more pressure. The same thing is true if you go deeper into the earth, you have experienced more pressure. So that pressure actually compresses the gas. Carbon dioxide at surface conditions is a gas form. But if we apply pressure to it, it actually goes through a liquid form and then what we call a dense phase, where it has properties similar to a gas, but density similar to that of a liquid. So it takes up less space in the subsurface. It almost has the density of water, very similar to that of oil and gas, which is part of the reason it makes such a good fluid for enhanced oil recovery. It has a similar density to the oil that you're trying to extract, and it also mixes more readily with oil. one of the reasons that we can do this effectively is we look for those suitable seals. So it is a little less dense than the formation fluid, so it tends to rise vertically. But that's where we look for suitable seals, so those shales that would prevent it from moving vertically. And we also do a thorough assessment of any type of penetrations through the seal. These would be existing well bores, for example. There doesn't happen to be very many well bores in the region around Milton R. Young's power facility, but any that have been there, we have assessed and determined that they are safe, and we will be monitoring them should the project go forward to injection.
Now, once this takes place and you've sequestered the carbon about a mile underneath the North Dakota prairie, does it have to be monitored? And if so, how long does it have to be monitored?
Yes, it needs to be monitored through the duration of the injection period, and then it needs to have some post-closure monitoring. The minimum would be by state primacy would be about 10 years, and it could be longer than that depending upon how the CO2 is behaving. If you see that it's, if your monitoring techniques indicate that it is not migrating, not moving laterally in any direction, the pressures in the subsurface are stable, then that would indicate that it is basically stable in place and not moving. And so you may be able to cease monitoring after the prescribed period from the state of North Dakota.
Let's talk about the value of this research and the application of it to the coal generating industry in North Dakota. There's been a lot of concern around the world, of course, about environmental and air pollution and the global warming kind of effect that everybody's focused on, or most people are these days. What value can you put on this particular technology to ease the concern people have about what comes out of the smokestacks?
Yeah, with this type of a project, we can produce power that is reliable 24/7, regardless of the temperature outside and whether the wind is blowing, and at the same time have zero carbon emitted to the atmosphere, or maybe there's just a very small amount of carbon emitted to the atmosphere, much less than a gas-fired turbine, for example. We have hundreds of years of lignite right there at the surface. We're not having to transport that anywhere, just mine it at the plant, produce reliable power, and then have zero carbon or very low carbon emissions. So it provides that, that reliable power at the same time as providing a power that has no carbon or very low carbon.
Well, this test of the project that you're proposing at the Milton R. Young plant is made possible by over $17 million. What is the cost benefit here in terms of how much would it cost to do this, for example, at Coal Creek or some other power plant in the state? And how does that affect the price of electricity?
It's a great question. The CO2 capture and storage projects are very costly endeavors. A capture facility could be $1 billion on a coal-fired power plant. The way that these are being financed is the federal government passed a set of tax credits known as 45Q tax credits, which says that for every ton of carbon dioxide that is captured and stored in the subsurface, the capturer can get $50 per ton tax credit. So you could do some quick math on that. If you're storing 4 million tons per year in the subsurface, you can capture that tax credit for 12 years as the law is written now. You could potentially pay for $1 billion capture facility. That's kind of the rough numbers. The challenge of it is that our power utilities are not for profit. They don't have no way to utilize a carbon credit. They need to seek partners who do have a tax appetite that can invest in the capture facility. At the end of the day, the effect on the consumer that buys the power is you don't have an increase in your power cost because of this tax credit.
Given the competitive price of natural gas these days, and of course these things can change, will this added cost in the short term disadvantage coal?
That's a great question. I don't know if I'm the best suited to answer that. Certainly the low price of natural gas is a challenge for coal to compete in the marketplace, but that can change very quickly. We saw in the polar vortex, for example, challenges where the wind wasn't blowing, or it was too cold at that time for the wind turbines to go. At the same time, we had a lot of demand for natural gas for home use, and we were challenged to be able to supply enough gas for power production at that same time in certain areas. So, you know, it may be competitive in price on natural gas, but you do have that great reliability when it comes to mine mouth coal-fired power plants.
We're talking about Project Tundra, which is aimed at aiding coal-fired power plants in the state of North Dakota and sequestering that CO2. There are other projects, other bits of research that are going on, I assume at the EERC and for that matter elsewhere around the world, which would use that CO2, perhaps in oil and gas extraction.
Absolutely. That remains one of the great areas of research that we're doing at the EERC. We have been recently producing as much as 1.5 million barrels of oil per day in North Dakota. That's probably shrinking at least some right now with our present price environment and the demand reduction that we've seen as a result of COVID-19. But certainly, enhanced oil recovery is a great technology in which you could capture carbon dioxide from a point source like a power plant, utilize it for enhanced oil recovery, utilizing the wells that you've already drilled, the oil you've already found. And at the end of the day, you could produce power and oil that have a lower carbon footprint or carbon intensity than power without carbon capture and oil that's not being produced from enhanced oil recovery. So there's a definite win-win there if you can link those both up.
What about using this Project Tundra sequestration process for other energy-intensive industries? Maybe they're not making electricity, but they're making steel or something like that.
Absolutely. Carbon capture, utilization, and storage is one of the only technologies for some industries, such as you mentioned, steel, cement, other industrial processes. There may not be a switch that you can do where you eliminate the carbon emissions. So carbon capture, utilization, and storage is the option or the best option aside from not creating those products to reduce that carbon intensity. There's a project in Norway called Northern Lights. The process there is they're going to be looking at capturing carbon dioxide from a number of different industrial facilities, collecting all those together and storing them offshore North Sea, which they currently have a couple of projects there now.
Well, let's talk about the issue of the moment, and that's the pandemic. Has that hampered any of your research processes at the EERC?
Well, it certainly has affected the EERC. I'm calling you from my house right now.
Yes. I'm talking to you from my basement.
Yeah, me as well. So most of the EERC staff is working from home. We do have a few people working at the EERC now on some of our in our pilot facilities and our laboratories. So it certainly has affected us, certainly has affected some of our partners. They're experiencing these same types of challenges. But we are 100% open for business and working. I think that we were ideally set up for working in a virtual manner. We've been doing it for a long time, not at this level, but we've been doing it a long time. And so we're open for business and helping our partners as much as we possibly can. The research projects continue to come in. The Department of Energy and others are still putting out funding announcements, and we're competing into those. So we have our challenges, but we are also, I think, handling them as best we can.
Well, remind us again of the timeline here for this test of the technology at the Milton R. Young plant. When would the sequestration begin, and when would it be declared, suitable or unsuitable?
That's up to Minn Kota to decide. They need to go through, as I mentioned, the FEED study first on the capture. Simultaneously, we're working on the subsurface side. So we're making sure that the subsurface is suitable, working towards that permit. They're working towards that same type of a timeline on the FEED study. Should all that come out to look positive for Minn Kota, they would make a decision in the next couple of years.
Well, when you look down the road, if this is successful, do you see drilling rigs outside of most of these coal-fired power plants in the state?
It's certainly possible. I think we need to see a few successes in how these projects get financed. We need to see effective permitting, which I think we were going to see from the state of North Dakota in our industrial commission. So I think it's entirely possible. We've also been working with our partners at Red Trail Energy They've been working towards a class 6 CO2 injection permit there as well, outside of their ethanol facility. So capturing carbon dioxide from their ethanol fermentation process and compressing that and storing it in the subsurface as well. So we're really starting to see that commercial deployment of the technology, which is really, for me, gratifying since I've been working on carbon capture, utilization, and storage since I started at the EERC in 2007.
How big a game changer is this? I mean, the United States, of course, has a lot of coal-fired power plants, but China builds them by the dozens. How might this change the world's output of CO2?
As far as volumes, I couldn't tell you exact volumes, but this is one of the places where the United States really needs to show leadership, and I believe we are. By developing those technologies in the United States, we're able to then transfer them to places like China or Africa, where we expect to see power demand and growth continue for a long time. And if your resource is coal, for example, and you're a developing country, and you've got many of your populace living in energy poverty, it gives us the opportunity to develop those technologies so they can utilize their resources to produce reliable power and then help bring their populace out of poverty. So I'm really excited about it. I think it's a game changer for the globe from a reduction of carbon emissions and also to allow for us to bring people into a higher standard of living and at the same time benefit the environment.
Well, I thank you for spending time with us today.
Well, thank you.
Charles Gorecki is CEO of the EERC, the Energy and Environmental Research Center at UND.
Hi, this is Bill Thomas at Prairie Public. Hey, remember back in the olden days when we used to go out to eat?
Good afternoon, sir, and how are we today?
Gather for morning coffee in a cafe? A dinner date?
Je sais bon faire.
You speak French.
Well, here's what we want to know. Where's the first place you're going to go when the eateries open again?
The first place I'm going is Mezzaluna. They are the friendliest and most welcoming staff I've ever experienced.
Just go to prairiepublic.org/firstplace to tell us the place you miss most.
I want to go back to the Laughing Sun Brewery and have a beer with my friends.
We'll put it out there. We may even call you up to talk about it. Hey, and we'll do a drawing and someone will get a gift card to that first place you'll go. Go to prairiepublic.org/firstplace.
Things are quieter than usual here in our newsroom, but not because there's any less news to cover. Our staff is dispersed. Many of us are working from home to bring you Morning Edition, so we understand that loneliness and social isolation are very real concerns. But we will be right here to keep you informed and to keep you company. We're not going anywhere. Stay connected with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.